Ever since Detroit made unwanted history with its bankruptcy filing, there's been a mountain of opinion as to what got Detroit there, what happened, and why. There have been many accusatory fingers pointed at black leaders like Kwame Kilpatrick, Coleman Young, at union leaders, even at Detroiters themselves. But there are, of course, other views about just what went wrong with Detroit. One such view comes from Marilyn Katz of Chicago. Marilyn is a longtime liberal political and social activist dating back to the 60s. She was an active member of Students for a Democratic Society, the SDS, and played a leading role in the SDS demonstrations during the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. Marilyn Katz recently published a piece on the website inthesetimes.com. It's titled Detroit's Downfall, Beyond the Myth of Black Misleadership. Marilyn Katz joins us now from Chicago, where she heads up her firm MK Communications. Marilyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You write that by the time Coleman Young was elected Detroit's first black mayor, and that was in 1973, that in your words, Detroit was already on life support and they were the hospice team. Why was that?
Well, ironically, and really little known, is that by 1967, Detroit had already lost 500,000 residents and, as important, 128,000 jobs. So even though there's the mythology is that Detroit was a vibrant city, it was the center of auto production, the city itself was the center of auto production, by the time of the riots of 1967, there were very few auto jobs left. More than half had already left the city. And in fact, the decline and the pattern of decline had already been set. In fact, it's really interesting that that happened really also by 1960. And in 1961, not 2001, was the first time Detroit had a deficit in its budget, a deficit of $15 million.
So you're saying Detroit's fate was really sealed by 1960?
It was. And why this is important is that, in fact, it's a pattern that I think has more lessons for other American cities. So what happened was, as everybody really knows, the history of Detroit in the 30s and 40s, particularly during the war, thousands, millions of people flocked to Detroit because while it had been the center of the world of car production during the Second World War, it also started producing the tanks and airplanes for the war effort in World War II.
Sure, the arsenal democracy.
Mm-hmm. And among those, about 300,000 African Americans moved to Detroit. And why this is pertinent, it was the first time, because previously blacks had pretty much been locked out of the auto industry. They moved to Detroit, moved to, you know, not the best jobs in the auto industry, but into well-paying jobs, and they settled in Detroit. During that same period of time, and particularly during the end of the war, the UAW, the United Auto Workers, won great labor victories, really stabilized wages, won working condition rights, a lot of great things. At the end of the war, between 1947 and really 1953, many, many things changed. And some of them, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's really about the movement of capital. During that period of time, as the auto industry was gearing up for domestic production again of cars, in the 10 years intervening of the war, automation had taken place. The auto companies decided to build new plants that would accommodate the new technology, and those were horizontal plants rather than the multi-storied old plants. And the reality was that Detroit at that time didn't have any available land. It had grown very densely and quickly.
Right.
And also, and this is actually in congressional testimony, the auto companies wanted to move and decentralize their production. They built, between 1947 and 1953, 25 new auto plants, none of them in Detroit.
So we saw Ohio, Indiana, Canada. The suburbs of Detroit?
The suburbs of Detroit.
Okay.
And therefore, that's the, you know, 128,000 auto jobs alone, both auto and related industries, went to the far-flung suburbs.
But as you say, one can understand just logistically, they wanted to incorporate these new horizontal designs, and there wasn't room in Detroit. So I guess on one hand, you could understand that.
There's also a lot of congressional testimony during that period of time in the La Follette Commission. It was also very convenient because they felt that if workers weren't congregated together, both in neighborhoods and on public transportation, their power as a union, there would not be the same urgency and desire to unionize. I mean, so it was a very class-conscious act at the same time, and very quickly afterwards, as you know, GM and other companies, other auto companies, lobbied very successfully to dismantle the public transit systems of Detroit, Los Angeles, and other cities.
So Detroit streetcars that went up and down Woodward went away.
That's right. Okay. Los Angeles streetcars. So there was it's convenient. And one of the things that it's really hard for modern day all of us to remember is that, the white workers all moved to the suburbs. Many of them did. The first 500,000 people left. And again, kind of logically, to where the jobs were going. But African Americans were prohibited from moving to the suburbs.
So even if they wanted to, there were ways to keep them out.
There were ways. There was no fair equal housing law then. Yeah. There was no fair housing. And in fact, by covenant, by design, these were white-only suburbs. So you have, by 1967, a city in which blacks are locked in. The good jobs, actually, almost all the good jobs have left. And you see a trend where those who still had jobs, and you have no way for blacks to get to the suburbs because there is no public transportation. Many of their neighborhoods had already been torn asunder by the freeways that were built as the federal funding for public transit dried up in the 50s and was transferred to highway construction.
Yeah.
So you have a perfect storm by the time. And so by the time you get to 1960 and definitely by 67 and definitely by 73, your tax base is not only diminished by the loss of jobs and population, but the jobs that are left there pay half of what the auto jobs did. They're service industry jobs. So this is what happens to Detroit, where both a diminished and less economically rewarded population is trying to support city services that were created and built for a city of well-paid and twice as and another half million population, and that was better paid. So by the time Coleman Young, by the time of the riots, which certainly propelled more white people and more industry to leave, you were already seeing the frustration of a people left behind in a ghetto without jobs, without transportation, and without money.
And that was a number of years before Coleman Young came.
And that was even before Coleman Young. Now, to be fair, not the Coleman Young, none of the leaders, there are problems with the leadership. I mean, Coleman Young should have tried to annex the suburbs. They wouldn't have let him because suburbs were all white.
Well, and he started off by telling, the bad guys, hit 8 Mile. So he was not exactly a bridge builder.
That's right. He was not a bridge builder.
No.
And he was angry, at everything that had happened before, whether or not he understood that this was a permanent condition. And it is a permanent condition because you can look at what happened to Detroit and what happened to Gary and what happened to Cleveland and what happened to Newark, and there's a pattern there.
Now, in your piece, Detroit's Downfall, Beyond the Myth of Black Misleadership, you point to this kind of what you call, this myth that it's the black mayors that have caused this, it's the union leaders. And why is that such, in your view, a convenient or popular myth?
Well, there's two reasons. The benign reason is, and it affects us all, which is when we look at a child, a friend of our children's, who goes on drugs, we'd like to think, it was something the parents did or something, so that it protects us from thinking it could happen to us. That's one. If we can blame something on somebody who's not us, we feel safer that it couldn't happen to our city, our child.
Yeah. So we're not like them.
We're not like them. And the second thing is an underlying racism. I mean, we live in a country with tremendous racial prejudice, and you just have to look at the treatment of the President of the United States compared to all presidents heretofore. And it's easy for white people, who are mostly in control of the major media, to think that black people are incompetent and likely to be venal.
When you had, for example, all the trial activity around the now imprisoned Kwame Kilpatrick,
absolutely reinforces the worst stereotypes that already exist in the American mind. And, what is dangerous about that is, Richard, this is not news, but I think none of us really think about it very seriously. In the last 5 years, as everybody knows, the U.S. has lost hundreds of millions and millions of jobs. And the recovery that we're seeing is replacing what were traditionally high-paid or well-paid manufacturing jobs with low-paid service jobs. And if you look at almost any city in the United States, save New York and Washington, D.C., what you see is that 70% of the workforce is working in service jobs now that pay sometimes half of what the previous employment figures were, and that we have to really take the what happened to Detroit as a big warning sign. And because the same shape of the economy in Detroit 1960, 1970, 1980, 90 seems to be seeping across most American cities today.
So when we hear talk of casinos or big sports arenas as being a hopeful sign for a rebirth of urban areas, you're saying not so much.
I think two things. I mean, obviously, I think there is tremendous energy both in Detroit and New Orleans and St. Louis, where the cost of living is very relatively low. And there is an influx of artists and what Richard Florida, who's a sociologist who writes about this, is called the creative class. What I'm saying is, however, the overall shape of economy, whether it's got a casino and an art gallery and there's some urban revival, is not enough. I mean, and that if we're going to learn from Detroit, we have to have a strategy that not only tries to attract tourism, but make sure that the artisans, we need to rebuild the manufacturing capacity that we can. We need to retool. We need to really do what Germany and France and other countries have done with advanced manufacturing. But that's not a panacea either. I mean, one of the things that I really think is that, well, I think a lot of things, but one of the things is that it's going to be really critically important that those that we change our remuneration of those people working in the traditionally retail, sales, food service, and hospitality. If they're not making $15 an hour, if they're not making a livable wage that doesn't cause them to be on Medicaid or Medicare or whatever, our cities will not survive.
Marilyn Katz, she's with MK Communications in Chicago and recently published a piece on the website inthesetimes.com. The title of the piece, Detroit's Downfall, Beyond the Myth of Black Misleadership. Marilyn, thanks so much for speaking
with
us.
Thank you. Thanks.